Session number 10763, row 6.
Wing Commander Lucas, rail 6.
And the difference between the two C's in C was striking to me. I mean, Sholto Douglas, I felt, was a really comprehensive commander-in-chief. He had all the personality, he had the intellect, he'd got a very good degree at Oxford. When he'd come out of the service at the end of the First World War, he went up to Oxford. He'd been in the RFC. He was, as I say, a comprehensive man. And when he was dealing with the very senior people at the Air Ministry, the CAS and so on, and I used to see this going on daily, you always felt that he was really on much the same sort of level. And when he used to go off with the chiefs of staff to, say, Chequers for these weekends with the Prime Minister and so on, one felt that he really was up to the part entirely. And I had one extraordinary experience when I was there. It was a weekend, and I was on the dog's body on the day operation side. The others were off. And this was the day of the operation that they did to the Brest Peninsula with the first lot of flying fortresses. It was very much a sort of an embryo operation before they got into their big daylight offensive against Germany. And this was a simply terrible experience, because the Spitfire 9s, which composed the wing, among them was 133 Squadron, which was an American Eagle Squadron, which was then led by an Englishman called Brettel. And because Red McAlpin, who was, I think, the squadron commander of it, was then, curiously enough, in London, talking, I think, to the American authorities about the transfer of the squadron to the United States 8th Air Force. You know, they all went over to the 8th Air Force, to the 8th Fighter Command, to form the nucleus of their fighter command. And of course, it was the most marvelous thing for the USAAF to be able to have these three Eagle squadrons as the basis of their fighter command. I mean, that's another story. But anyway, they had gone down there, and there was a problem about the wing leader. I think he hadn't got there in time. And this operation went off, really, to want of a phrase, really went off at half cock. And the principle of the thing was that there would be a rendezvous with the fortresses at 15,000 feet in mid-channel. It's 120 miles across from the Cornish Peninsula. And they were flying from Bolt Head in South Devon. But from the peninsula across to the Brest Peninsula is 120 miles, I know, because I can remember that very well from the time of 66th Squadron at Perranporth. And that was actually on one engine in those days. It seemed a very long way. Well, anyway, this was supposed to be a rendezvous at 15,000 feet in mid-channel. And then they were to go in with the fortresses, which were going to bomb, I think, the targets on the Brest Peninsula, and then they were going to come back. It was just an in and out job, a simple operation, and the wind speed was given, I think I'm right in saying, at around 40 miles an hour at 20,000 feet from the southwest. That is to say, if it were going that way, it would be coming from the right front, a bit against going down and blowing them substantially home coming back. And I can remember these. I went down to the ops room at Fighter Command, and for this operation, and we could pick up the plots, you see, on the ops table at Fighter Command, and it all started off all right, and then they went further and further and further and further down, right past the Brest Peninsula. Two squadrons in the wing had turned round and come back, because they didn't fancy it. They hadn't made rendezvous with the bombers in the channel, because there was, instead of it being clear at 15,000 feet, there was 10-tenths cloud up to about 20,000. And this chap, Brettel, who was leading 133, the American squadron, went on. He went up above the cloud, and he was an inexperienced leader, and an Englishman, of course, at that, which made a political problem. And these plots went on and on and on, and I can remember ringing up the Exeter controller, and I said, whatever's happened? And he said, well, we've lost sight of them, and we've lost contact with them over the RT. They've gone too far away. Well, anyway, to cut a long story short, what happened? They got down to damn near the Spanish frontier, down past Biarritz, Bordeaux and Biarritz, right down past the Bay of Biscay there, and they turned around and came back. And when, because they had been, nearly the whole thing was over 10-tenths cloud, when they got to their ETA, their estimated time of arrival coming back, the leader, Brettel, said to the squadron, close up, and we'll go down through this. And they went down through it, and they saw this land and a promontory over the top, over down on the ground beneath them, when they broke cloud, I think at about 3,000 or 4,000 feet. And he said to them, now, come on, fellas, let's get in close and really do a good fly past here. Really, you know, he used to do that when coming back over land. And he thought that this was the Cornish Peninsula, and it was Plymouth or one of these towns, ports. And, of course, then suddenly the whole thing started to open up, all the flak and breast, and there was plenty of it. And we could hear these fellows now on the RT saying, tell these bastards to stop shooting us. Can't they see that we're friendly? Well, of course, it was too late. One of the aircraft in 133, I think, had turned back because of engine trouble. So I think there were 11 of them, as I remember. And anyway, this was this appalling thing. And, of course, the explanation for it was simply that the Met forecast was all wrong. Instead of it being a wind speed at 40 miles an hour from the southwest, so i.e. roughly sort of against going out, it was over 100 miles an hour from due north, which was just simply blowing a mile south. Now, this chap, who hadn't got the experience, just went on. I mean, he should really have known. If he hadn't, made rendezvous with the bombers, and it was all over 10-tenths cloud, it should have told him that that's no good, we must go back. And like the other two squadrons, one was a Canadian squadron, and I can't remember the other one. But anyway, this was the most frightful reverse, because these were quite new Spitnines. It was an American squadron, an Eagle squadron, with all the associations, the political associations. Well, Sholto, Douglas, was away, staying at Chequers, with Churchill and the other chiefs of staff. And the instructions were that in no circumstances was he to be disturbed unless there was some emergency. And so I was a dog's body. I had to make up my mind whether he should be told or not. Well, you know, I'm in age, whatever I was, 26, 27 or something, and a squadron leader, and a very small fry in an air staff like that, where they're all air commodores and this and what. And I thought to myself, well, I'll have to make up my mind and I'll do it. And I thought, well, to lose a squadron is something. To lose a Spitfire 9 squadron, where we just got these 9s and they were getting to grips with the 190s, that's another thing. But for it to be an American squadron as well, I mean, there was a trinity there, which was really very imposing indeed. And so I rang him up, and I'll never forget it. He said, what is it, laddie? And I said, well, sir, I'm afraid that there's bad news. And I went through the story very quickly. There was a pause the other end. He didn't say, oh dear, what a disaster or something. There was absolute silence, and he said, I shall be back tomorrow night. That's a Sunday night. He said, I want a full report on my desk by the time I get back. I shall be back at 6 or whatever he said. And he said, on Monday morning, I want the AOC 10 group, I want the sector commander of Exeter, I want the senior controller of the Exeter sector, I want all the squadron commanders, and I want the wing commander flying, all to, and you'll have told the group captain, and of course, anyway, all through that, to be in my office at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. Understood? And I said, yes, sir. I put the receiver down. We scramble, you know. And so we got on and did all this, and they had the meeting. And in the end, of course, it was found out that the Met forecast was absolutely all wrong, and that was it was the most terrible thing. But basically, it was the leading of the English flight lieutenant. It wasn't a squadron leader; it was flight lieutenant of the squadron, which really was at fault. Now, an amazing thing happened about 1982, I think it was, or 83, might have been a little bit later. That lovely Eagle Squadron memorial in Grosvenor Square opposite Roosevelt, the Roosevelt statue, was unveiled. And they had all these Eagle Squadron survivors over, I think there were 244 Eagle Squadron pilots, and I think they had 124 over here. I know that a number of them came here for one on the Friday night, and I think it was on the Monday that they had the unveiling. I'm not quite sure of the day. And I sat next to, well, Dixie Alexander, my mate, who was in one of the Eagle Squadrons. He had asked me to this thing, and I was sitting with the Americans instead of sitting with my wife, sitting with the sort of Royal Air Force and that, who were there. And so, and I was sitting with Dixie on my right and Bob Smith on my left. Now, Bob Smith from Washington, D.C., was in 133 that day when they were lost. And he told me he was the only one who escaped. The other ones were either killed or they were shot down and they were taken prisoner. And Brettel was killed in that escape from Stalag Luft 3 when they all escaped and he was shot. You remember, Roger Bushell was the leader of it. I mean, it was a terrible thing. And you know, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but I suppose, really, looking back now, it was almost a blessing in disguise, because if this thing would have haunted him for the rest of his life. Anyway, I said to Bob Smith, sitting here, I said, "My God, Bob, you know, 133, well, you couldn't have been in it when this thing happened." "Oh, yes," he said, "I well, certainly was." And I said, "Well, what happened to you?" And he said, "We when he went through the story, we were going very tight over breast," he said, "and all this shit was coming up," he said, "and I got hit. But I got away to the east, went east through Brittany, almost into Normandy, and steered a bit south, and put the aeroplane down in a field." And he said, "I destroyed the aircraft and I got away, and I was helped by the underground, and I got away to Gibraltar, and I finished up, and then I flew again with the United States 8th Air Force." And I said, "Well, you really were lucky." And he said, "Well, I certainly was." And I said, "Well, what do you reckon really went wrong?" "Well," he said, "good God, it was the leading," he said. "I mean, if Red had been, Red McAlpin had been doing it," he said, "he would never have done that." And that was as far as he went. But anyhow, it was a terribly wet day that day when they were unveiling. It was, the unveiling was done by the American ambassador and the prime minister. And this was just after the Libyan bombing. And the embassy had said to the Prime Minister, "Look, because of all the security problems now, after the American bombing of Libya, I mean, really, we would very well understand if you didn't feel that it would be right, or your advisors didn't feel it was right for you to take part in this." You see, apparently it said to Charles Price, because Charles Sweeney, who was the chairman of the thing, told me this, and he was in the chair that day. He said, the Prime Minister apparently said, "Well, it's the last thing I do, I'm going to come and to this unveiling. It means a great deal to us," which was fine, really. Anyhow, this unveiling took place. It was pouring with rain, and we got these sort of canopies over, and this Bob Smith, he had got one of these long-range cameras, Leica cameras with these long-range things, and he was going round, sort of panning the tops of all these buildings all the way round, where there were people with automatic weapons, I mean, the SAS and goodness knows what, over the top of the Canadian High Commission, the American Embassy here, old Joe Levy's block of flats over there, and a hotel there, and they said he was going all round, and I said, and round and round, he never stopped for about sort of 3 or 4 minutes taking film. And I said, "Bob, what ever are you taking those films for?" "Oh," he said, "gee, back in Washington, D.C., they'll never believe it," he said, and I can remember as well. But anyway, this thing at this time of mine at Fighter Command, it was a marvellous experience for me, because you'll appreciate that just as an amateur in the Air Force, going in at the beginning and coming out at the end, to have the privilege of being able to serve on an air staff of one of the principal commands was a tremendous experience, and seeing these very senior officers at close at hand at work with all the traumas that used to go on and the arguments and the sort of internecine strife that used to go on between these staffs and the members of it. It was a marvelous experience for me. I got the job, I think, principally because, obviously, having been a journalist, they thought that I'd be all right on paper, and it was a great experience. Now, just towards the end of it, I think I'd done 5 months, and Lee Mallory had taken over from Shotter, as I've said, and this was a great change, because I always felt with Lee Mallory, he was quite a different fish from Sholto Douglas. He always gave me the impression that he was insecure, in the sense that I felt that he was a bit inferior to these very senior people at the Air Ministry, the CASs and the DCASs and this and the politicians, it was being, and he was always straining a bit to do the job, whereas Sholto Douglas, who was a buccaneer, I mean, I think some of the things that old Sholto did at Fighter Command probably wouldn't bear close examination, but I mean, he knew exactly where he was going. He was his own master, and he painted on a broad canvas, and he was overall a very comprehensive operator. Now, Lee Mallory never gave me quite that impression. I liked him, I got on with him very well, and he was very nice to me. But he did give me the impression of being about two or three rungs down the ladder from Sholto Douglas in terms of personality and ability and command. I think he was straining to do the job a bit. But anyway, I mean, later on, of course, he was made the air commander for the invasion of the continent. And when I actually, jumping on a bit, when I came back again, after my second tour, because I went off and commanded a squadron and then a wing in my second tour, and when I came back, we came back to do the planning for D-Day and then all that flying bomb business, crossbow, that. And Lee Mallory was then, of course, the CNC of the air side of the invasion. And I still felt the same thing with the meetings. I felt that really, he hadn't got the presence that Sholto had naturally. I always felt that he was trying to, he was almost having to blow himself up. I'm being unfair to him, but this is perhaps a bit unfair, but this is an objective view that I formed, and I don't think it was far wrong, because he'd been, before he'd gone to Fighter Command, he'd been, of course, first of all, the AOC and 12 Group and the Battle of Britain, and then he went to 11 Group. And I think that basically he was one of those people who found his premier level as an AOC of a group dealing with the pilots. I mean, they all liked him. I mean, for instance, my wife's brother-in-law, Bader, thought the world of him. He was his AOC and 12 Group in the Battle of Britain. And he was his AOC at 11 Group subsequently when he had the wing at Tangmere in 1941. And he thought the world of LM, and and I used to talk to him about it, and I used to say what I've said to you about the difference between Sholto and LM. And he said, well, I think, oh boy, you're not really fair to him. And so I may not have been fair, but I felt that he was, rather in the way that when I was serving under Churchill in the House of Commons, I just felt that he was bigger than anyone. I felt that Sholto was that much bigger than Lee Mallory. But I can always remember at the end of my time, after the planning was over of D-Day, this is on further on, and I was then thinking about going back and doing a third tour, when the planning was all over and our friends were in the continent, on the continent in France, landed in Normandy and they were moving up and so on. I said to him, sir, do you think, because I was a sort of dog's body there with him, he was doing all these odd jobs, and I had an opportunity one morning, I took some files or something into him, and I said, sir, do you think I could go back and fly again, because I've now been off, whatever it is, 6 months, and I'm due to go back. And I'd like to. My friends are all in France. Do you think I could have a Spitfire wing again? And he said, laddie, how old are you? And I said, I'm 29, sir. And he said, you sure you aren't 30? And I said, no, I'm 29, sir. And he said, well, that's too early to go back and lead a Spitfire wing. Anyhow, you're wanted here on the staff. You're much more use here, he said, on the staff. You're leading wings. There are plenty of other people who can do that. So I thought about it, and I didn't want to argue with C's and C. And so I waited for a bit, and I saw my friend Basil Embry, Air Vice Marshal Embry, who is the AOC of 2 Group in the 2nd Tactical Air Force, and his Mosquitoes, you know, were operating day and night doing these interdiction sorties, low-level pinpoint thing on targets and prisons and that, and railway marshalling yards and all that in support of the armies. And he had his headquarters, I remember, down at Wallingford on the river. And I'd got to know him quite well because he had been on the staff, on Lee Mallory's staff at AEAF. And I rang up his PA, Peter Clapham, who was a friend of mine, and I said, do you think you could get me an appointment to see the AOC? It would only take 10 minutes. And he said, oh, I should think so, he'll see you. And so, and Peter Clapham was his PA and also his navigator. He used to fly with him, you know, on these 2 Group daylight operations. I mean, it was a murderous affair because Basil wasn't really in practice. He was a marvellous pilot, Basil. He'd got DSOs galore, about 4 of them or something. And he'd been shot down once or twice, and he'd shot his way out. And if he had ever been caught by the Germans, they'd have stood him up against the wall and shot him. I mean, there's no question of it. And anyway, so Peter fixed this up for me, and Basil Embry said to Peter, well, get him to come and have lunch. What does he want? Wants a job, I suppose. And Peter told me this afterwards, and anyhow, I went down there, and we had lunch. Never talked about any job or anything, and then when the lunch was over, we had a lot of friends of mine there. He said, now come into the office. What do you want? You know, and he would stare at you. He'd got a pair of gimlet eyes, and he'd get right up against you, so his nose was almost against yours. And I can see him now looking me in the face, because I was just a little bit taller than he was, and he had to look out. And I said, well, sir, I was wondering whether you would give me a job. He said, I thought that's what you'd be here for. And he said, what's the trouble? Have you put up a black? I said, no. Anyhow, I went through the story with old LM, and he said to me, all right, well, he said, have you ever flown Mosquitoes? And I said, no, sir, I haven't. Do you think you could? And I said, well, sir, I mean, I could do a conversion course and try. All right, he said, well, you go to Bicester. You'll have to go down to squadron leader. And he said, you go to Bicester and learn to fly Mosquitoes. And he said, if you don't put up a black there and you manage all right, he said, you come over and I'll give you a make you a supernumerary squadron leader to one of the squadrons in France, wing 138 wing at Cambrai. And if you don't put any blacks up there, I'll give you a squadron. Well, I thought that was pretty fair. I didn't mind going back to squadron leader. And so anyhow, all this went, and I went to Cambrai. And within a matter of about 5 weeks as a supernumerary squadron leader, he rang me up one day and he said, so-and-so's going off, I'm going to give you 613 squadron. Do you feel all right? I said, yes. And well, anyhow, you wouldn't ever say to Basil Embry that you didn't feel all right, because you'd be lack of moral fibre absolutely instantly. But anyway, he was a marvellous chap, Basil. He was absolutely true to his word. And so, but that was the second time that I was just lucky in these 2 rest periods that I had, first of all, that period with Sholto Douglas and then Lee Mallory right at the end. And then, after I'd done my second tour on Spitfires in the UK, and then had the Côte d'Azur wing at the end of that, and came back at the beginning of January 44 onto the air staff again, and we were doing the planning for D-Day and all the crossbow stuff, which was extraordinary, really. I was on the staff each time, and it was a marvellous experience. I mean, these other friends of mine were always sent off to OTUs and instructing. I mean, I couldn't bear the idea of trying to teach someone else to fly an aeroplane. I mean, all I could do to fly the blooming thing is myself without teaching someone else. And so to be allowed to serve on the staff. And, you know, I spent since the war a lifetime in business, and I've seen sort of administration of big companies and all that, and I've always admired the process by which the Royal Air Force, I don't know anything about the Army or the Navy, but the process by which the Royal Air Force conducted its staff work. I thought that the standard of staff work in the Royal Air Force, mark you, I was very lucky because I served with very good ones. I mean, McAvoy was absolutely exceptional. He and Evill, I suppose, who was SASO at Dowding, I wasn't there then, at Bentley Priory. He was exceptional. Then he went to the Air Ministry, of course, afterwards. I think that he was an exceptional staff officer. But this Theodore McAvoy, Mac, was a marvellous... I still keep in touch with him now. He's got this spindleitis, this awful thing, which is... used to say to me, he was... Before he went to Fighter Command, before he went to 11 Group, he went from 11 Group to Fighter Command. He was always in Fighter Command. He commanded Northolt. And he flew and that, and you know, with this awful disease where he was bent absolutely double like this, he used to fly with mirrors on his hands on a Spitfire, you know, because he couldn't turn his neck, his head, and he used to use that mirror and he used to use these mirrors to see if there's anything coming behind. And when I was on the staff with him there, that time in 42, end of 42, early part of 43, he used to go off and keep his hand in, and he'd go off to Northolt and fly, you know, for half an hour and do aerobatics all over the place and then come back and get on with his staff work after lunch. And he used sometimes, when he had to go off for a medical, which he did quite frequently, but with this awful thing, he used to say to me, I'm just put his head through the hutch in the wall, there was a dividing wall between the two offices which communicated. He used to put his head through the cubby hatch, cubby hole, and say, I'm just off to see the medicos. He said, see how many pieces of cigarette paper they can get between my chin and the ground. And you know, I mean, he had this marvellous sense of humour. He was a lovely, lovely man, one of the dearest people, and I should think that one of the most sort of fervent group of followers in the Air Force of anyone with the people who served under Mac at Fighter Command in those days. I mean, there was, as I say, Barry Heath, there was Scott Malden and myself, and there was Walter Churchill before. They were absolutely devoted to him. He was a marvellous chap. He finished up as secretary to the Air Council as an Air Chief Marshal, and he was brilliant. But anyway, that was really, I mean, those were my two rests, and there was only just a slight variation of it, and that was at the end of my first rest, when Lee Mallory had taken over as CNC from Sholto, and Sholto had gone to the Middle East. It was at a time when we'd lost a lot of leaders. They had lost quite a lot of leaders in the Battle of Britain, and then over France, and sweeps over France and that sort of thing, they had lost people, and they felt that they wanted to train more flight commanders, flight lieutenants, and squadron leaders and wing leaders. And he started